Hello and welcome back to Railway Mania. It is often said that the rule book is written in blood. Changes in safety often arise only after the worst has happened. With me today is someone who knows this more than most. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the show Dan Fox of the Signals to Danger podcast.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. If anyone's listening and they haven't heard of your podcast, could you just give us a little summary of what it's about?
Train crashes. Unfortunately, it's not the most cheerful sounding subject, but it is, in essence, a podcast about train crashes. The way I've always tried to describe it to other people is if anyone's ever seen the television programme Air Crash Investigations, where they tell you a story about what happened and how it happened, and it's digestible and not just a wall of text, that's what I try and do.
And that's exactly what it is. And it's fascinating. And I think that it does sound a bit morbid, but the focus on causes, reasons, and outcomes, I think, is the thing that really attracts me to it. Knowing that there was a reason that something happened and what steps were taken to mitigate that in the future is really interesting, especially looking at the entire history of British Railway history as you have done.
Yeah, and I think you could make a podcast about something like that and make it very sensationalist and a dramatic piece. And then, you know, if you think disaster movies where no one ever unpicks it afterwards, it's just really dramatic and...
Well, like Victorian Penny Dreadfuls, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not what, you know, that's not what you want to do. I think the point is to sort of understand, look, it happened, but this is why. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, I say, because maybe not in every case, we fixed it now because of this.
Well, I'll come on to a few of those in a bit. First, I want to rewind and I want to ask you, because I ask all my guests this, so where did your interest in railways come from?
So I think probably like many of your guests, childhood. I've always been interested in it. I grew up in the Northeast, Saturday trips with the family, York Rail Museum wasn't particularly far away. Walking around with me dad, I think, mainly enjoyed it, but my mum and my sister as well, and seeing these huge lumps of metal and reading how they used to travel around at 100 miles an hour, inexplicably through the power of water and fire. And just, I've always had that interest in it, and it never really went away.
And you ended up working in the rail industry.
Yes, although not until 6 years ago, admittedly, much later than I would have liked to. Mm. But I currently work within the rail industry, work for a train operating company.
There's two questions attached to that. So one is, does your job involve anything to do with rail accidents?
No, it doesn't. And probably would. So the role I do now is it's our community manager. So I've done a few other jobs in the past for them. I've used to work as a station team leader and then a group station manager. So there was a safety element in the group station manager piece. I was investigating, you know, slips, trips and falls and things like that. And, you know, accidents that had happened on the stations that I managed. But the current one is much more about outreach to community rail partnerships, rail user groups, education establishments or colleges and schools. And, you know, the good stuff like getting staff volunteering for things. And it's a nice part of rail, but it can be challenging when things aren't going too well.
So it's almost the counterbalance to your podcast then, which is the darker side of rail.
Do you know, admittedly, I would absolutely love to work in the safety side of rail, but this is the role that sort of saw it advertised and thought, I'd love to do that. There's a real outreachy part of the job, and rail's very much part of the community. I think that's probably more important now than it ever has been. So to be able to be part of that and try and shape that is worth having a crack at.
Definitely. Especially as we're looking at trying to change social travel patterns and methods.
Exactly.
Tying in with car ownership. Are we going to see a reduction in that over the next few years if we can improve rail to that extent? I guess you're getting all that kind of feedback from the coalface.
Well, exactly. I think one of the other things, so part of the job is I work within sustainability. That my role sits within our sustainability team, and a bit off topic for the subject of the podcast, but, you know, we're talking about climate change, and the biggest contribution that rail can probably make to that is through modal shift and getting people out of cars and getting them onto a railway which is greener. And there's lots of projects going on up and down the country now to try and make rail greener, and hopefully we'll see things move in the right direction over the next few years.
Definitely. Yeah, I hope so too. Well, in my day job, I do work in the sort of climate change sustainability side of things as well, and it's something I'm always wanting to try and push into subjects, just ram it in and say, what about trains? Don't forget about trains.
Yeah, I do that.
So your podcast looks into incidents, crashes, tragedies, disasters with forensic detail. second-by-second breakdowns in some cases about what happened. But how do you approach the subject in a way that's informative but respectful at the same time?
So I've always, I think I said the word before, like sensationalist. I've never tried to do that. I don't want to make it a drama that's about something that happened and we all just go away from it thinking, oh, that was terrible. I wanted to have that level of detail. And it probably ties into the way that I actually started doing the podcast was I used to work at an airport doing night shifts and sometimes there wouldn't be many people knocking about. So we used to watch TV series on YouTube. I've not worked there for 7 years now. I'm probably all right to say that. but one of the programs that was available, full episodes, was Air Crash Investigation. And let's not talk about the challenges of maybe getting caught watching that when passengers walk through an airport on the way to their flights. But lots of careful pausing when people walked into the office. Anyway, that program fascinated me because it does give you this really nice forensic breakdown of how the accident happened. And there's a bit of drama. They have that bit at the start where they show you and tell you the story of the accident. But from watching them, I started reading NTSB reports, the National Transportation Safety Board, which tend to investigate most of them because they're all American aircraft. And I thought, well, actually, that TV program was great and it was an hour, but the level of detail that's in this report is fascinating. And for some reason, I then started reading train crash accident reports, be that the Health and Safety Executive, the RAIB, whoever it was who did that one. And there was one that I read very early on, which was Great Heck. And I just thought, this is fascinating. So then I started looking for a TV program that told me that and showed me that. And it didn't really exist.
No, I so recall I thought, only one that comes close. And it was about the Southall derailment. And
Seconds to Disaster
episode. Yeah, I think it was, yeah. And they had like CGI trains superimposed over satellite imagery to show where all the wagons were each time and that kind of thing. That kind of second-by-second breakdown that you do. And that's the only thing I can think of that I've seen before that does this.
Yeah, and that for me just felt like a real sort of blind spot. I knew I found this really interesting. And I'm a massive nerd. I know that. I know that there's not many people happy just sit and read.
This is a safe place, Dan.
Then that's okay. I am a massive nerd about this stuff and I found it really interesting and I read the whole thing end to end, however many pages it was, and then I thought, I bet there's people out there who wouldn't read that but would find the content really interesting. So I set about trying to come up with a way of doing that.
And it was Great Heck that caught your eye, which ended up being episode one of Signals to Danger.
Yes, yeah.
One of the things that I was talking to a friend of mine, a fellow volunteer earlier, who is an avid listener of your podcast, and what he described it as, the best thing as, he translates it into English so you can understand it. Because it's obviously the reports come back and it's pages and pages of information. And if you're like me and you struggle with large blocks of text, you end up getting that wall of text feeling and you read the same thing over and over again. And I think having it given to you in easy to manage and easy to understand chunks is incredible. And that ability to communicate things clearly. How did you get to that point?
Well, some of that wall of text, I can pick out paragraphs that I've read over and over and over again just to try and understand myself. Because it is, I mean, they're written very well and they explain everything in sort of this forensic detail, but they don't always explain it in a way that explains it, if that makes sense.
There's a lot of assumed knowledge, I think.
I think there is, and especially if you go back to some of the earlier ones where you've got the the military titled Her Majesty's Rail Inspectorate, and they are writing things, and if you don't understand the industry, if you don't understand those things, it can be really difficult to unpick what you actually meant by that. And I think some of the early reports, and to be fair, some of the later ones as well, they meet the criteria of having this publicly available record of what took place, but it doesn't mean that it would be understandable by half the people who read it. It's there.
It's like trying to read Hansard.
Yeah, it's just kind of very... If I was explaining this to a friend who didn't know the railway, what would I say? How would I say that? And I think I'm getting to the point where I'm comfortable with being able to explain things in this sort of clear English sense of things by either comparing it to other things or not using the jargon when the jargon would just hinder it.
Yeah. And I think also the industry struggles with acronyms and initialisms because so many people know what those mean, but if you don't, it's just gibberish.
Absolutely, and there's some that mean different things depending on which area of the industry you're in as well. You could have LLC, for example. So LLC would be your local level council if you're talking about relationships between a company and a union. Right. So that's like your local area council. but it's also landlord's consent if you're speaking to Network Rail and you want to build something on a station. Then there's loads of them, and I'm by no means au fait with absolutely all of them. But we do love an abbreviation in the industry. It's definitely clear to see that.
Well, imagine how long the reports would be if you couldn't do them.
Well, yeah, a lot more words. And I think the other challenge there is it's not just, and this is the one that I struggle with still to this day with some things, is you're not just translating it into a way that you can show people. It's for an audio medium. And some of the stuff that you want to describe is, I get to the point where I'm saying, look, please just go and Google this picture because it won't make sense as well as me trying to explain it.
How do you think you evolve the podcast from that first idea then? How did it become the podcast that we know today?
By way of not becoming a book or a YouTube series originally. So that was, I took this idea of just making a way of telling these stories in a more digestible manner. And I originally set out by thinking, right, I shall write a book because I like writing things. And, there's a limited number of books on the subject, I think, especially, the one that everyone goes to is LTC Rolt's Red for Danger. Mm-hmm. But there's a section at the end of that book which says recent accidents, and the most recent one in there is Lewisham, which is quite a way back.
Yeah.
Because it is an older book that was written at an older time, and I thought, maybe I can do that. But then I started thinking, well, actually, how can I engage people who are surfing the web and things like that? I shall make a YouTube video series. And I have this really nasty habit sometimes of almost falling into a bit of a rabbit hole and doing things. So I thought, I could make some video with some stock footage, but actually I'd quite like to have a little animation in there. So I took that, thought, right, I shall go, I'll download Blender. I'm going to learn how to do 3D modeling, and I'm going to make a model of this 91 and then the coaches, and I'm going to do an animation of this train crash. And a month later, I had actually an impressively passable model of a 91, but that was it. I spent a long time trying to learn how to use this program.
And then multiply that month by...
Exactly. I thought, if I'm ever going to do this, then it's going to be a labor of love. It's going to last for 12 months, maybe, to pull one 10-minute episode together. This is a bit of a non-starter, really. But then I got listening to podcasts. Never really been listening to many of them before. And there was one that really sort of caught my attention. And it was, it's called Disaster Area. And it's by a woman called Jennifer Matarese. And she does these sort of about an hour's length episodes where she talks about a disaster that's taken place. And it might be a train crash. It might be a plane or a ship that's gone down. Or it might be like a crowd crush theatre fight. It's anything. It's quite a varied range. And I just sat there and thought, maybe this will work for what I want to do. So I took the microphone I'd bought for making my voiceover for my YouTube video that never happened and wrote a script and recorded it.
And then did you go through any sort of iterative process with that to get to the first series, which is massive? I mean, how many episodes are there in the first series?
Now you're asking. The first series had about 20-ish, maybe 23, 24, something like that.
27?
Is it 27? I'll take two of them away because two of them were specials, I think. There was an ill-advised Sounds from the Scenes 25th episode anniversary where I'd recorded some video in London. I thought, I'll try and do something like that. It was a nice idea, but I don't think it quite translated. And I did a special on AWS, which I then abandoned as a concept as well. So I sat and I wrote my script down. I thought, right, this is what I want to say about it. Let's see if it works. Found a podcasting host, uploaded it, and then just told a couple of people about it and thought, let's see if anyone finds this interesting. I was expecting like 30 downloads maybe in the first few months of people listening to it, half of which would be me just testing it on different platforms.
Yeah, playback.
Yeah, exactly. And it actually, people listened. Small numbers at first, because that's how these things work, but people were listening to it and people were feeding back. So I thought, okay, well, I might have to write a second one here.
The pressure's on.
Exactly. I thought, people like that. How can I make it a little bit better? And just focused a little bit more on how to tell the story, making the performance isn't the right word, making the performance less wooden and sounding more like me just explaining something as opposed to reading a book to you. And I did experiment with some bits and bobs. So some of the earlier episodes, I think, have got some background music underneath all of it, which I did away with because I thought it actually detracted.
I think music beds are really hard to get right.
Yeah.
So full of drama that you really want to focus the listener's attention.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I found some that they worked, but then getting the right sort of length track is a bit more challenging. And there's
something that doesn't become grating after a few minutes, yeah.
So I then said, right, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to have my sections of the podcast, and I'm going to punctuate that with a small musical interlude that leads you into the next section. And then it was just a case of getting used to how I was writing it and just trying to make it more polished. When I originally started, there was always a section at the end where I talked about another accident or another incident that had happened that was similar to the first. And I phased that out after a little while, because I think I talked about it throughout the podcast instead of this like follow-up section. Mm. And as I got more confident in how to explain things and how to tell the stories, the episodes started to get a bit longer.
Yeah.
So having spent, you know, what started out was probably about 45 minutes-ish for the earlier ones, and then we're becoming... It's not unusual for one to tip the 1 hour mark now and to then add another section on the end of it.
Yes, I understand that. And then, of course, series three is launched with the 3-part special.
Yes, which I think is about 3.5 hours in total.
I was explaining it to a friend of mine who had just started listening to the first one the other day. And I was saying, just wait until episode two. It's amazing. like when you actually find out what happened and you find out why it happened, just keep listening.
And that surprised me, because I never intended, when I started writing season three, episode one, I never intended it to be a 3-part episode.
You had a Hobbit moment. Had to become three in the end.
It had to. It just, there was too much story to tell. But no, so the way I tend to do things now is I choose which accident I'm doing. And I write a series of headings that are the sections of the episode and what I'm going to cover. And that might be a tale of the West Coast Main Line if I'm introducing the West Coast Main Line at the start, and then the story of the accident. Maybe I'll do a bit more in depth about the actual stock itself that's involved. And then I'll break down the investigation into the sections that I think are worth talking about. And I had all of that set out for Carmont. I think for context, most of the episodes are about between 7,000 and 8,000 words length in script. And I got to sort of closing out the accident itself at Carmont, you know, that first section, talk about the accident and then lead into the investigation. That was up to 7,000 words, and I'd not even talked about the REIB getting on site. I thought, I'm going to do this as a multi-part episode.
Well, let's talk about the 2020 Carmont derailment. So this is one of the more recent incidents. It might be the most recent incident that you've covered so far.
It's definitely the most recent one I've covered. There's been a few other ones that are probably noteworthy since and might well be episodes, but it's definitely the most recent one.
And how does covering something that happened in the 2020s compare to the more historical ones that you've done?
In terms of actually making it, I found it not challenging. I found it difficult to write. So actually writing it hasn't been difficult in terms of getting the information, because the report itself is incredibly detailed. When I compare it to some of the earlier ones, so I did Shipton on Cherwell as a Christmas special in year one, and I think that was about 3 pages. The whole report was about 3 pages, so I had to do a lot of digging outside of that and filling in the blanks a little bit to understand it and to make it. I think it was only 40 minutes, but to get that 40 minutes was quite a bit of effort from that, whereas... the report into Carmont is about 280 pages long. There is so much detail in there. They actually, when they did the report, it's the first one I've seen where they had a synopsis section at the start, which basically told you everything you needed to read if you were just wanting to know the reason or reporting on it. And the synopsis goes up to about page 40.
My word.
And then the rest of it is this full report. And the detail is fantastic. So if someone can spare a couple of days to unpick it, it's really worth a read. So I didn't find it challenging in terms of getting the information or understanding what had happened, but I think I was abundantly aware all of the way through that I know that I've got a good group of listeners that are from the industry.
I know that definitely that there's quite a few people in the industry who do listen to it.
Yeah, and there's always this thing in the back of my head that's been going on while I've been writing. I did mention it, I think, in the closeout of episode three, that abundantly aware that someone might be listening to it who had been personally affected by it. And it's one thing, you know, if I'm writing a Shipton on Cherwell, that was from 1874. That is a long time ago. There's very little risk that anyone will be personally affected by it. But I thought Carmont it's the first one that I've done a sort of real standalone trigger warning. I generally haven't done trigger warnings for the podcast because of what it is. It's a podcast about train crashes. If you're going to find train crashes distressing, then you'll be aware of what I'm talking about. But for Carmont, I did, because it's really, really recent. It's raw. You know, there's people involved who are very much still working, who will have been there on the day.
Did you find that the sheer amount of information was actually made it harder because there was so much of it and you're trying to work out what to cut out.
That's probably why it ended up being three episodes long. a little bit. So I talk about in episode three, I talk about crashworthiness, for an example. And there's about four or five out of 10 factors that I didn't cover because I thought it's just adding words in at this point. I tried to pick out the main bits that are important to that and again, point people to the report if they want to hear everything. And there's been a few times that I'll always make sure I get the important stuff, the things that were crucial, the things that tell the story of the accident. But there's definitely things that won't make it in just by virtue of there's a lot in some of them. So it was challenging having that much information, but a lot of contemporary media as well, which was helpful. So it's not just the accident report. It's, you know, this is a train crash that took place in a world where people had camera phones and drone footage and live streaming news that's happening on the day.
Not only the fact that it happened during the pandemic, you point this out in the first episode, there had been such a long period between the last passenger fatality from a train crash.
Yeah, really. So I remember it now. I think it's about 13 years, give or take. And the last person who actually died before, so it was Christopher Stuckbury at Carmont was a passenger that died. And tragically, because we've managed to go 13 years, we have had, it doesn't mean that the RAIB hasn't had the misfortune of investigating fatal accidents, because they have, but they've tended to be track workers, people involved in the industry who were doing jobs that should have been safe but weren't because of a flawed process or things like that. But this was the first time that a passenger who just got on a train, you know, just to make a normal journey, didn't make it home because of something that happened on the railway, a train crash. The one most recently, you've got to go back as far as Greyrig for that one. And that was Margaret Masson, who was also from Scotland, coincidentally, from Glasgow. It's a bit of a shock. I think that's one of the reasons why the industry reeled, and not just because we'd lost two of our own as part of the accident, but because, you know, one of the things we're really proud of is our ability to protect the travelling public, even if sometimes they don't want to be protected or they do everything they can not to be.
Well, it's that old thing about having to reset the counter on your safety record.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I recall, and you may remember this, when Southall happened in the 90s, and then almost it felt like a ridiculously short amount of time afterwards. I think it was 2 years. Ladbroke Grove happened. A very, very similar reason for the accident, signal past the danger. I remember there being a feeling in the news and in the media and the public, is this going to keep happening?
Yeah.
Like, there seemed to be something really wrong, and it seemed that I was in school at the time, and I remember kids being scared about rail travel because their perception was that train crashes are happening all the time. And obviously, you know, car crashes are so common that they didn't get reported on. They didn't get marked on, which I tried to convince them at the time. They were unconvinced. There's a definite improvement in safety, even within my lifetime.
Absolutely. I think it's sort of a gallows humour sort of way of once referred this to someone as almost like a golden age of modern train crashes. Because we had this awful period from sort of Southall, sort of four or five years over the turn of the millennium, where we had so many in such a short period of time. We had at Southall, we had Ladbroke Grove, Potter's Bar, Great Heck, Ufton Nervet, all in about a 5 year period of time. And these aren't, you know, little bumps where no one gets hurt. These are
Big smashes,
multiple fatalities, you know, videos of train carriages crumpled or bent and on
but
fire.
I think Great Heck is the outlier there because of the cause of the crash being caused by a member of the public.
Probably one of the reasons why I picked it as well as the first one, because it was...
Well, should we just give people a little synopsis on what it was? This was the incident when the driver of a Land Rover, was it?
Yes.
Fell asleep at the wheel, went off the road into the path of a train, which then struck the wrecked car and derailed.
Absolutely. So a wonderful chap called Gary Hart, I believe. I might have been wrong on that. Remember, but he had been up all night messaging a girl he'd met online, and then decided it was the right time to drive his car, his Land Rover with a trailer with another car in it, across the country. Fell asleep at the wheel and ended up on the East Coast Main Line. There is a recording, I think, of the 999 call that he made saying, oh, I'm on the train tracks, oh, there's a train coming. And then a southbound service, GNAR, southbound service collided with it. There was a I think it's a switch turnout rail that was between the tracks, sort of between maintenance. You quite often see it. It's not a big deal, but it directed the front of the train over to the right slightly where it collided with a freight train heading northbound. So you had this horrific high-speed collision between two trains and just scattered both of them, really. And I think that one was so many things had to go wrong in exactly... If you'd fallen asleep...
100 yards, yeah, up the road, he would have just gone into the side of the road.
If he'd gone 10 yards further down, he would have ended up bouncing back into the carriageway off the crash barrier. If it had been 5 minutes earlier, we might have been able to get trains stopped. If the freight train was heading north early, so it had they'd stuck at a signal and said, look, we're good to go. There's no conflict with path, so the signals let them move. Nothing wrong with that. But because of this, it was in exactly the wrong place at exactly the wrong time. And it's just so many little things had to align perfectly for that terrible accident to take place. I've always thought it's a really good example of the complexity that's involved in these reports and the train crashes. And
you contrast that with the others that we just mentioned about that era in the 90s when it just seemed that everything was going wrong on the railways, that there's two signals past at danger.
Yeah.
And then you have Potter's Bar as well.
Yes, you've got a few that are... I mean, Ufton Nervet's an outlier there because that was someone who parked his car in a level crossing.
Yes, I remember that one. That was awful.
Yeah, absolutely terrible. But yeah, so you have got broken rules or mistakes in terms of the signals past as danger. Southall, that was a really clear sort of procedure that someone didn't follow that essentially led to that. And Potter's Bar and Hatfield as well, actually. We're talking about Potter's Bar and maintenance issues.
And that was the end of rail track.
Yeah, that very much changed the scene. So Potter's Bar was a set of points which didn't have stretcher bars fitted where they should be or fitted incorrectly. And Hatfield was track that hadn't been maintained or monitored properly, which broke underneath a train at line speed. Mm. And those are definitely, they're accidents where someone did something wrong. It shouldn't have been done that way. And it's led to people losing their lives. As a group, they did contribute massively to changes in how the railway was run, which is thankfully why we started to see less and less of them.
Well, I was wondering if we could move on to that. So can we break down into three main areas of what you think the key learnings were from each era? So if we look at, say, the Victorian period, the late Victorian period, which you've covered quite a few times, what do you think the key changes were in that arose out of the accidents that you've covered?
Oof, no, that is a challenging one. And as I'll caveat all of this with, I'm a documentary maker as opposed to a railway safety expert. So if I do get any of this wrong, it's because I've probably not read it yet. If you look at sort of the Victorian stuff that we've covered, a lot of that is down to probably advances in signalling have been the real change. You look at Clayton Tunnel for an example of that. There's not really reliable system that just expected one person to make sure it was all going correctly and then not very well conveyed messages of stop and go and...
Or even confirming which train was
exactly.
Which. So in that instance, you have... He says, has the train gone past? And the person says, yes, but actually he meant the second train
exactly.
And not the first train.
And this awkward system of bells and things like that that were supposed to convey messages that weren't necessarily the clearest thing in the world, a signalling system that was supposed to reset itself to danger but didn't, or maybe did if you're not entirely sure on the signalman's account, but it relies a lot on the human factor. And you then move forward where signalling's changed, so you've got track circuiting so people can be more clear of where a train actually is. And you move from semaphores, which are mechanical signals, which can freeze and are not sure the correct ones. I think Castle Carry, that one was white conditions and a poorly lit lamp in a signal, but then questions about whether the signal arm returned to the position it was meant to. And you move to colour light signalling with increasingly brighter lenses, making these signals more and more easy to see. I think technology is one of the big things that changed that.
So if we look at the Victorian era specifically, the incident that you mentioned, the tunnel incident, they were relying on time interval signalling,
yes.
So not block signalling at the time, where you have a safe section of track and only one train can be in that section of track at a time. It's literally counting like on the hands of a watch about how long it should be before you let the next train through.
Which sounds insane when you think about how we do things now. And even looking at Clayton Tunnel, there was an underlying factor to all of it that was there was a rule that said trains leaving the origin station couldn't be dispatched less than, I believe it was about 5 minutes between them, to allow for variances in speed and things that had to stop them bunching up. But the station master had been dispatching them far closer to each other. So if it had been dispatched in the time that they were said they were going to, then there probably wouldn't have been as much confusion. It would have been clearer which train was meant when the messages were being conveyed to each other. And it does just show that how this early railway, where we're relying on literally watching a clock and a human being to do the right thing, it's not always reliable. It should be. Although it is a really good example of processes not being followed.
Yes. And would you say then that key sort of evolution over that period then is abandoning time interval signalling and moving to absolute block?
I think, yeah, absolute block is a massive change.
And then maybe we can put onto that the advancements in communications technology. So you have things that rely on electricity, the telegraph, for example. Yeah.
The ability for signallers to pass a train between them. Mm. I mean, there's definitely accidents that I think have covered and will cover where it hasn't done what it's meant to do. But just that ability to confirm this train is coming to you. Is your section clear? Yes, my section's clear. Please send it to me. All through bells and, you know, this quite rudimentary sounding way of passing trains along. But you can then control where the trains are, and signallers had an idea about where trains were even when they weren't in front of the signal box.
And you've hinted at this already, but then let's look at the early 20th century, moving into sort of the end of the steam era. Then what key advancements have there been? You mentioned colour light signals as one.
Yeah, I think for me, through doing the podcast, there's been one that has really made a difference. And I think I mentioned just a few seconds ago about people not following procedure, and it's really good to have this great signalling system that says, yes, my block's clear, send the train, or if it's not, your signal doesn't get cleared, and then the driver coming up to it sees the danger signal and stops. But what if they don't stop? What if they're not looking and don't see it for any reason, or if they're incapacitated, etc., etc.? And then I think we start to see some real interventions that protect people from the human factor. So sort of the automated warning system, really big one. And it was sort of
so
around,
this is what you're referring to earlier as AWS.
AWS, yeah, the automated warning system. And that's this fantastic system, which probably should have been around for a bit longer. The GWR were doing it in a certain form for quite a while.
Well, this was actually one of our listeners' questions, was the GWR had automatic train control, which is an early form of AWS, but relying on sort of a mechanical operation rather than electronic, in 1906.
Yeah.
But BR didn't adopt AWS until the 1960s, until after the Harrow and Wealdstone crash. So what do you think, given your observation of all of these crashes, a universal adoption of ATC could have made?
It would have prevented a few. There's certainly accidents that it would have prevented. So if you look at Harrow and Wealdstone, had that system been in place, we wouldn't be talking about Harrow and Wealdstone.
I promise that this isn't like a Swindon is always right podcast.
It's ironic, isn't it, that you know you have this horrible accident's taken place. It's the worst peacetime rail accident. It's the second worst that we ever see. Thankfully, I don't think we'll ever top those numbers just because of the way that vehicle design and everything's changed. But there was a system that existed that could have made a difference, and it just wasn't adopted. And I'm sure that many of your listeners will be aware, but the way that AWS works is as you're approaching a signal head, you will get an audible and a visual notification in the cab as to whether that's a clear aspect, a proceed aspect, or whether it's a restrictive aspect, so caution or danger. And it's as simple as if you're pulling up to it, or you're coming towards it, it will sound a bell if it's clear, and an indicator in the cab will stay black. If it's any restrictive aspect, it will sound a horn, and you'll get this yellow sunflower display.
And that's not like a computer display or anything. That is a mechanical thing that just shows yellow in place of black.
Yeah, a fantastic little system. And yes, there probably were more developed versions of it that could have been adopted, but just having that in general would make such a difference. If you look at a situation where a driver maybe didn't see a signal head or became disorientated because of the fog, like at Harrow, didn't see a signal, but he still hears this horn, he will then instantly know, right, there's a restrictive signal. I don't have a clue where I am. Maybe it's best to stop my train and figure it out. You don't get a collision. It's frustrating that that system did exist, but I think cost. And I think we talk about the rule book being written in blood, but I think we need to talk more about the checks that were cashed in it. The travelling public wants their trains to be safe, and they always have done. But you almost feel like there's calculations that that insurance companies do on how much a life is worth and how much the developments, how much that expenditure is, and you balance out as to whether it's worth it. I mean, I've always been of the mindset that if a technology exists that can save lives, you probably should be looking to implement that wherever possible.
And not wait until you're forced to.
No, exactly. You know, you don't need to have the second worst train crash in the UK to think about
adding. Well, we're straying a bit here. I've got another question, a follow-up question to that. Is, do you think that this was partially the fact that the railways were being run by private companies for profit and not as a nationalised system in those days?
Probably, to some extent. You have got, there's always an investor sort of argument, I think. And if you go back to the days of the Big Four, you had these Big Four companies that were running everything, and they're not running, it's not like the early days where they're only looking after their little bit of line, and these are massive, massive networks now by the time you reach the Big Four, with some lines that are very profitable, other lines that aren't very profitable. And there's probably a balance that they need to consider when they're looking to implement it. I mean, I'm biased. I come at it from the safety aspect, and I think, you know, in a perfect world, sod the cost and just do it.
Yep.
But that's just my two pence.
So we've got the introduction of AWS. Well, let's look at more modern times now. What do you think from Harrow and Wealdstone, the introduction of AWS all over the network, to now has been the biggest advancement in rail safety in the UK?
One of the ones I always sort of come back to is TPWS, so Train Protection and Warning System. AWS is really good. It will warn you that you're coming up to an adverse signal, but there's a flaw in AWS, which is you can cancel the warning.
Which is what we saw with the incident with Tangmere a few years ago.
Yes, absolutely. If you cancel it, then that's, you know, it's your way of acknowledging the signal. But if you acknowledge the signal and then do nothing, nothing happens. If you miss it, if you miss the window of time to acknowledge it, it will put the brakes of the train in automatically.
And then do you need to unlock it then to take the brakes off again?
I think it varies on the trains, but you've got to, some of them have to come to a complete stop and wait a little while, or do this, that, the other. There's varying, basically. And the rules always say if you have an AWS brake application, you need to contact the signaler. So you're not going anywhere for a little while, whatever happens if you miss your AWS acknowledgement. But Train Protection and Warning System sort of takes that idea and develops it, and it gives it other context. So if you have a signal with a red aspect, you'll have two loops in the track, and you pass over the first loop and it energizes the system. Now, it's all programmed to know that at this signal, if you are going to stop, you need to be traveling at least at this low speed. If you then activate the second loop before that time frame, so you're traveling too fast, train brakes come in automatically, you get an emergency brake application. And they can use that in other situations, like if there's a speed restriction on a section of track because of excess curvature or something like that, they can have an overspeed sensor built into the track there. So you hit the first loop. If you're traveling too fast, it'll trigger the system and bring the train to a stop. It's just other opportunities to capture the human error.
Well, human error plays such a... If you look back at your record of railway accidents throughout the three series that you've done so far, you definitely see a tendency for the early ones to be almost entirely down to human error rather than structural failure or, you know, mechanical failure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or passenger error.
And some of the more modern ones are where we've come into episodes where it's been circumstances surrounding. So taking Hatfield or Potter's Bar, for example, the train driver did absolutely nothing wrong. It was the circumstances external to the train, so the broken tracks. If we look at the episode about Lockington, in East Yorkshire, which is a personal favourite of mine because it's sort of up towards my part of the world. When I worked up there, that was somebody who drove out onto the train track and derailed the train because it's external influences that are causing these. It's not to say that there aren't human error ones. As recently as Chalfont and Latimer, we had a member of staff cancelling a safety system that said, oh no, you should stop your train. And he said, oh, that must be a mistake. Kept going and nearly went head to head with the London Underground service.
Yeah.
It still happens, but I think we, you know, the systems are in place to...
Well, and there were consequences to that as well. The huge... I think that this is an observation from someone who's very much an amateur. I'm not a railway professional at all, but I do feel like SPAD, or Signal Passed at Danger, has become something like a mark of shame, almost on a driver. Like, if you do it, you should feel ashamed of yourself. Whereas, possibly, back in the day when it was more common to do that... It may have just been as another one of those things that happens and you just reset. I remember a friend of mine who's a signaller down at Didcot. He sent me a picture of, I won't name the train company, but it was a freight locomotive parked outside the box. And he said, guess who's just done a SPAD right outside the box because of the ticking off that they get.
And it's not just that, I think, because we've become much more risk averse as an industry and we've got these safety management systems in train operating companies. If you have... We'll use the phrase like an operational incident to cover that sort of SPADs, spars, overspeeds, failing to call it a station, or calling it a station you weren't meant to be at. We it's taken really seriously. The driver's relieved. They go through what we call for cause testing. So they'll be drug and alcohol tested.
So this is any deviation from the plan?
Yeah. So if you have one of these operational incidents that even though it didn't, you know, it didn't cause an accident, but theoretically it had the potential to do it, it's taken really seriously. And then a driver may go through sort of a competence development. It depends on the circumstances, but each one of them is looked at really seriously. Going back many, many years, you probably had a bit of a clip round the ear and don't do that again. But that's not the industry that we live and work in anymore. But it shouldn't be. You know, we have this, you know, last maybe calm on the side, but we have this really safe railway, which is almost envied across the world because it is so safe. But it's safe because the systems are in place now to... Everything is serious until we find out it's not.
Well, like you, I also subscribe to the Rail Accident Investigation Branch newsletter that they put out after any sort of incident that's gone on and their reports that they publish. I remember one not that long ago, and it cited the fact that the lookout was too embarrassed to shout or to wave their arms in the specified way and that kind of thing. And it was about how this must be trained out of people. Like, yeah, people being too embarrassed to call out when their job is the lookout. This needs to be drilled out of them.
It's, yeah, and it has to be, because I think these systems that we put in place, like having lookouts, having people in charge of people working on possessions, they all exist to try and prevent these accidents. We've had some really horrible accidents with track workers. So, yes, we haven't had many passengers that have... We've had that one unfortunate situation, but track workers have continued being killed on the railway throughout. I think... If you scroll back through the RAIB's report list, there's plenty of them that are related to people killed just doing their job. And it has to be drilled into people that this is the process, this is what you need to do. Don't be afraid to shout up if you need to shout. Mm. I worked as a station team leader for some years, and I absolutely am comfortable shouting at someone on a station platform who's doing something dangerous. I've seen people do stuff, and I genuinely thought I was about to watch someone get killed because we're being so stupid.
Wow. It's not a nice position to be in.
It's not. I think my favourite example of that was watching, sort of doing a night shift and watching someone get off a train, young lad, probably 19, 20, bit worse for wear, and in the platform was a Network Rail sort of ballast train. So if you can picture those like half-height hoppers, probably come up to about you.
I can kind of see where this is going, actually.
Yeah. So he thought it'd be really fun to run up to the side of it and jump onto the side of the hopper. So he had his sort of stomach, chest sort of area leaning over the front of it just as the train started to move.
Ooh.
You know, five wagons, top and tail by class 68s. Driver was going to be ahead of the signal any second now, and the next signal wasn't until about 200 yards further down the line, round a corner. So if he'd gone down... The only way I would have had of stopping that train would have been to contact the signaller and ask him to put the next signal to danger. But by that point, it would have been, you know, far too late. And I was not nice. I was professional, but I was loud. And I called someone who was only a few years younger than me a stupid little boy, because he had been, and I think he needed to be told, you know. I genuinely thought for a second I was watching him go down the side of the train, because when he stepped back off, he jumped back off, but he sort of stepped back and his left foot was on the platform edge as it hit the platform. Ooh. Again. Yeah, and so he thought it was funny at first, and then I explained to him how I did not want to see him die. Because you have to feel comfortable challenging unsafe behaviour.
Something that's often quoted by people of a certain generation to me is how not used my generation is to death.
Yeah.
It just all around us. And what effect that has had on our perception of safety. But I think I would rather live in that world than the other one.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've not seen anyone get serious. I've been around stations where we've had people who have made a decision to do that. But I've never seen anyone who's been injured or seriously otherwise in an accident. But it doesn't happen nowadays. The industry is really, really safe. And I wonder sometimes whether to some members of the public who travel, that safety is not taken for granted, might not be the right word, but I don't think they have an appreciation or respect for how dangerous it can be.
Mm.
You know, when you see people who are stood right on a busy platform at a mainline station, and they stood right up to the platform edge as the train's coming in, and they don't understand that one nudge and or walk down the edge of a platform as the train's arriving, you think you slip and trip on pavements, and
no one means to fall over.
Exactly,
it just happens to you.
Don't please understand that this is a really big, heavy piece of metal that doesn't stop. I think people have lost sometimes that appreciation for it. Whereas if we lived in a world of sort of 20 years ago, maybe when things were happening a lot more frequently, there would be a bit more respect for it.
Well, it was in the news, as we said, you know, it felt like it was happening all the time. We saw mangled carriages and we heard reports of fatalities and things like that. It sort of 2 yearly intervals, it seems. Exactly. At one point. What I wanted to talk about as well was the RAIB, the Rail Accident Investigation Branch, and what impact do you think that the formation of that has had on rail safety and the rail industry?
I think it has helped. As a really simple sort of answer to that, is it really has helped, because the reports that they're producing are incredibly detailed. They do this in this really good way where they're not there to apportion blame. They're just there. I mean, they're there to say what happened and why it happened, which in all fairness, sort of de facto apportions blame, I suppose, if it's pointing at an error by a driver or a maintenance.
But it's not a court case.
It's not. And it is literally a factual unpicking. There's no agenda. There's no prosecution that the RAIB does. It's just a case of delving into the detail of it and understanding exactly what happened and why. Were there any cultural influences in the business before that did that? But it's not only the reports that we see. There's like reportable incidents that are part and parcel of, you know, as a train operator, if you have certain things that happen, you have to inform the RAIB about it. And this...
So these could be things like near misses.
Exactly. This accountability is really something that they provide, which is pretty helpful.
Well, there was an incident a while back at Whitby, where the North Yorkshire Moors Railway special, where the locomotive touched the buffers at the end of the platform, and the buffers have a red light on them.
Yeah.
So it's classed as a signal past the danger, and even though it was such a minor incident, it still had to be reported.
And things like that, I think in a less safe railway, would probably be bloody hell, what's he done that for? Let's just, don't do that again, you silly boy.
Mm.
But having that accountability, because you don't know, I think jumping on near misses and managing in the way that we do is important, because it's a near miss now. It might not be a near miss next time. I think you mentioned earlier on Tangmere incident, the heritage railway tour that was...
Oh, yes, Wooden Bassett.
That's what, yes, Wooden Bassett. So Tangmere was a locomotive. And it was a situation that maybe in the bad old days you would go, bloody hell, that was close. But it's a good thing that we didn't just do that as an industry. We unpicked it and we found out that there was really unsafe practices. And it was a near miss this time. But there's absolutely no reason why it wouldn't be a near miss next time if the timings had been out slightly there.
Oh, I remember talking to a previous guest in this podcast who is heavily involved in mainline steam, and he said it would have been the end of steam on the mainline forever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got the risk now with there's like the Flying Scotsman effect a little bit, where you've got lots of conversation in even the mainstream media about trespassers coming to take photographs of... And there's been talk about whether that puts heritage mainline at risk. But if you had a situation where a steam train ploughs on into a HST and causes death and injury, you got to wonder whether people would just turn around and say, right, no, there's too much risk, let's not have it anymore. Not to mention an utterly avoidable situation that was come about because of poor working practices.
It was unbelievably thick, I think, because it reminded me of those stories of in like the 1820s when drivers would get annoyed with the sound of the safety valves, so they just clamped them shut.
Yeah,
and then the boiler would blow up, and it's like that kind of thing is like what the AWS is annoying you, so you just isolate it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things they talked about was, oh, if you got this AWS activation, it took such a long time to build up steam again and get around the situation. I'll just disable that safety system. Fantastic, except you disabled it and then you ended up passing a signal at danger. The AWS didn't kick in and you nearly crashed into a passenger service. It highlighted some fairly unsafe practices. And there were actions taken with the operator after, which hopefully changed things for the better going forward.
Well, they had the license suspended, didn't they?
They did for a while. And I think they had another issue with another tour in the Doncaster area. I can't remember the exact details.
Because I think Wooden Bassett was the second serious incident, and that's what resulted in the revoked license.
A few issues with the way they were doing things. But unpicking it and actually taking the time to investigate a near miss in the same level of detail as you would an accident will mean that next time, there hopefully won't be a next time. You know, you treat it like an accident insofar as you're just lucky enough that no one actually passed away.
Yeah, exactly. So speaking about human error, the normal things that you go through in your everyday life, and you've touched on this a lot, especially in the Steam Days ones, because it is shocking how in the Steam era, how so many accidents are caused by forgetfulness.
Yeah.
You bookend Series 2 with Quinton's Hill at one end and Hawes Junction at the other end. Both incidents, the main cause of the crashes were the signaller forgetting a train that was directly outside their box. And in the Quinton's Hill incident, the signaller managed to forget the train that he had arrived on and that he could see.
It's insane. I think it's the only way. Because and Quinton's Hill is probably the best example of that. Because if you don't have these other systems in place as sort of checks and balances, just to sanity check what you're doing, the human mind appears to be really, really good at forgetting stuff.
Especially when routine is involved.
Yeah.
Bell goes, ring it through.
Exactly.
Switch the lever.
Muscle memory on the wrong side failure. But I think, so like you said, Quinton's Hill, he arrived on the train, it was visible from the box, but he absolutely just completely forgot about it. And I think sometimes people get so preoccupied with the process that they're meant to follow. You see it sometimes with dispatchers dispatching a train. If you give your first signal to the conductor against a red signal, it's a dispatcher regularity. And I did a bit of time dispatching trains a while ago.
So to the uninitiated, these are people who work at the station and they'll be on the platform and they will give the signal to depart that everybody's loaded to the guard of the train?
Yeah, so you'll give two, we call the slang is tips, but the proper word is you sort of give your platform duties complete where all your passengers are on board the train, you give a signal to the conductor to close the train's doors. And then once all the doors are closed and secure, you'd give a second signal to the conductor saying train ready to depart. If you've ever seen people with sort of a baton and a whistle, that's what they're doing. They're forming
part. So this is like the little table tennis racket.
That's the one. I call me Waggler when I was doing it, because you hold it up to the conductor and you give the signal. And that just, it helps make the dispatch process safer when you've got a busy station or you've got longer trains. And you know, trains can self-dispatch at small stations. We've all seen it, but sometimes having that dispatcher is much, much safer. And it's an extra pair of eyes making sure everything's all right. But if you give that first signal to the conductor, but the signal is still at red, the mainline signal for the train is still at red, that's a dispatch against a red, you know, job stops. We then unpick what happened and fill out a report to say that we did something bad. But the amount of times that people have given that first tip because they've looked at the clock and gone, oh, that train's ready to depart now, and then just turned around and given the tip. You know, there were times when I got close to doing it, because you think, all right, oh, if that train's out at 58, it's 57 and 30 now, I better give my tip. But then you sort of check the signal and think, oh, that's still at red. But there are plenty of situations, I think, where people will, because you get locked into the process of this is when it needs to happen. And the rail's always got the sort of the timetable pressure in there as well. And that's why introducing these systems that check our natural urge to get stuff moving.
In the privatised era, when train operating companies can be fined for leaving stations late.
Yes, always helps. Well, delay attribution is a massive part of the railway where this train's delayed by 3 minutes. Why was it delayed? Whose responsibility is it? Right, who's paying the fine? And there's always is this pressure to get things moving, but not at the expense of safety. And luckily with that dispatch process, you have three pairs of eyes all watching the signal. So you as a conductor, if you gave your tip against a red signal, the conductor's going to go, nope, that's not right. But they might not, because they might forget to check the signal as well. And then the driver's going to do it. And suddenly the driver might stick his head out of the cab and go, what are you two playing at? But having that extra layer of protection, that extra person checking the signal, just keeps everyone right. It's the, you know, the Swiss cheese model of safety. You don't want your slices of cheese with the holes to all line up. And then when you put an extra block in there, there's less chance of your holes lining up.
Yeah,
it's a ridiculous sounding thing, but it's a proper a safety concept, Swiss cheese. All your slices, and you don't want your holes to line up. But if all your holes line up, you need another control in place to stop them.
I'm going to remember that one. We're talking about human forgetfulness and that impact on railways in the steam era. Do you think that it's specifically those checking systems, so basically adding another layer of human checking systems, combined with the advances in, say, electronic and computer technology that has made that possible?
Yeah, and I think even as early as going back to your mechanical lever frame signal box, there was a recognition that forgetfulness is a thing. So you have, if you take that lever frame box as an example, if you have blocked a line with a train, so say for example at Quinton's Hill that the main line was blocked by that train, so you could have fitted a collar, a piece of metal, a tube onto the signal lever that would have controlled the signal into that area. So if you'd thought as a human you'd just completely forgotten that you'd left a train in the way, when you went to the lever to pull off the signal for the next train to come in, you'd find this collar on the lever. It would physically prevent you from doing it, and it would remind you, oh yeah, there's a train there, I can't do that. And that's something that's been replicated through. And if you move to the point where you've got these power signal boxes with panels on the wall, you can put caps over the buttons so you physically can't clear a signal.
So is that so it looks like the nitrous button in like a race car?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like a flip-up cover, but like a literally a cup almost, I guess, that you'd put over it, a collar onto the button to remind you, do not clear that, there's something in the way. There's signals out there that if you're sat waiting for a certain length of time, you're supposed to contact the signaler to remind him that you're there.
Well, this is something that you talked about in the Hawes Junction incident, because
yes,
there were basically two returning banking engines heading back to base, and the signaler had forgotten they were there. But at no point did the driver say, we've been waiting here a long time, I better go and just check that he knows we're here.
Yeah, and it came up in Quinton's Hill as well. Now, I'm just scraping my memory now. I believe that was covered by something called Rule 55, and I might be wrong. I think it's
anybody who has known the Thomas the Tank Engine fandom will know about Rule 55, because basically when they made the TV show, the TV writers started taking over the train movements and stuff like that and how things worked. And the Reverend Audrey was not happy about this. And he said, in the rule book, there is a rule that says Rule 55. And he has quoted that.
Fantastic.
That back to the TV makers, who ignored it, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
Because they wanted their trains to be doing whatever they wanted.
I mean, I accidentally stumbled on the new animated version of Thomas the Tank Engine the other day with my daughter, and I was horrified by trains jumping off the tracks and jumping in muddy puddles, so let's not talk about that one.
I don't want to talk about it. My childhood. My poor childhood. Right, can we talk about a few questions from listeners? So,
yes,
Elias asks, should the Board of Trade have mandated train brakes on goods trains earlier, and would this have prevented many incidents? Now, there is a counterpoint to this, which I'll come to in a minute, but I want to ask you about this because you've covered a lot. And often these are to do with passenger trains because of the scale of the disaster is obviously a lot worse when passenger trains are involved. But a lot of them are caused by goods trains and the practice of having unfitted goods trains.
It's an interesting question. And I'll be honest, because I've not covered an accident that sort of talks much detail about that, I'm less knowledgeable about it than I could be to answer that question. Going back to I'm a documentary maker, not a rail safety expert.
Very clever getting that excuse in,
isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Just get that caveat in on top of everything. I would argue that if you go back to the days of rail, when everything essentially was moved by rail, every bit of
freight.
Well,
the common carrier period. British railways companies were obliged to carry anything they were asked to carry.
Exactly. And you have, you know, the number of lorries on the road were much less, and to be fair, the roads to travel on were probably far less convenient for moving freight around. Exactly. Yeah. You could understand the sheer quantity of goods vehicles, meaning that to start fitting systems to them would be vastly expensive. I would, again, this is going back to my sod the cost, do the job mentality, that if you were starting to implement these systems on passenger locals and these passenger stock, and this passenger stock is sharing routes with the freight, that it would probably have been a good idea to replicate the same sort of level of system.
Well, I think the workaround that they ended up at was that they just kept the freights moving at 25 miles an hour,
which isn't very good for a timetable which is flexible and paths, etc.
No, or to even compete with the emerging road transport industry.
Exactly.
The counterpoint that fellow listener Limmy raised was that you could actually be introducing a danger there, because this was the days of wagon load freight. We grew up in the modern era and we basically only had train load freight, or so that's essentially like a whole train filled with one type of goods going to a specific destination. And this isn't specific wagons going to different destinations that all have to be broken up in a yard and reassembled in a different order and then shunted and everything else like that. So going between and coupling up was a much more common practice. But what you can do with unfitted stock is you can couple it from the outside with a pole, but you can't do that to connect brake hoses from the outside. Yeah. So you'd actually be putting shunters' lives in far more danger if you did force the stock to be fitted.
And it is a good counterpoint. Not one I can answer, and that's the problem. This is an area that I will admit my knowledge is pretty slim on.
Well, you did talk about it. You talked about the danger to railway staff is still there and it's still present today. Because they are operating at track level, up and close with these machines. And it was always the way with that. And it's just an extension of that.
It is. I think that's... You can always protect a dangerous activity with process. So if it was to introduce a greater risk by asking shunters to climb in between trains to connect up air hoses, then that could have been accompanied by a process that tries to make that safer. There always would be a risk from coupling just from the outside. You're still working around heavy things that are moving. There's still that momentary lapse of concentration that can be your last ever lapse of concentration.
Mm.
But again, I think it's probably the safest option is to introduce a system when it becomes available, but we'll always find that cost will be a prohibitive factor.
Also something that, you know, yours and my generation hasn't had to live through was the age of coal.
Yeah.
So much coal was moved by rail back in the days, and that coal requires unloading. Sometimes that's with hoppers. How do you build a hopper wagon that's robust enough to withstand use by sort of NCB personnel on rickety industrial trackwork and on the main line that also has brake lines running underneath it? You see where the reasons for this come from. But I guess my question was really, if they had made it possible, what kind of accidents could this have prevented? I guess the obvious one is runaways.
Yeah, absolutely. Runaways, broken couplings, things like that. I can't think off the top of my head any that would be a really good example of it. But that fact, you know, you lose half a train and no one knows it's there, especially if you go back to the time when time interval, or I don't believe, or maybe someone may come in and correct me on this, but I don't believe at the point we were doing absolute block signalling that signals would be routinely counting the vehicles of every goods train that passed.
So no, I think it would basically come down to the fact that does it have a light on the back?
Exactly. And that would be your sort of warning sign. But again, a lapse of concentration in the signaller.
Yeah, you're just not looking out the window at the right time.
Did I check that? Or the telegraph bell rings at the back of the signal box, you're going to do that. Maybe he's a bit keen to go and enter the train in the register. Mm-hmm. Then you have the wonderful situation that light might be missed and he might just assume the train was complete because the last 15 times it passed the box it was.
Mm. Elias also brought up the point that Raven on the North Eastern Railway was developing a fog signalling apparatus, which was a signal repeater that showed the position of the upcoming signal in the locomotive cab. And it makes you wonder as well, as like, why wasn't this adopted? And cost is obviously one of the biggest factors. But you've cited Harrow and Wealdstone as a signal past at danger in dense weather.
And I think if you go back to that era, there are a lot of people who were trying to do things differently. And the GWR was a great example with AWS. They tried to come up with a safer system. I believe the Southern was doing stuff around that kind of thing as well. But I think with them, the area suffered from fog a lot more. So I wonder whether they were experiencing...
Yeah, this was the Thames Estuary area.
Yeah. So I wonder if they were experiencing the issue more and therefore thought it was worth putting the investment in. And then you look at other areas of the country that maybe weren't having the same scope or the same level of issue.
Or the incident didn't occur enough times in a row to make it viable to...
Exactly.
...spend millions of pounds, presumably, on upgrading everything.
And we have, you know, we have this thing now, in-cab signalling starting to do the rounds again. You know, we've got the ECTMS, the European Control Train Management System. I want to say off the top of my head, I might be a little bit wrong on that. But that is a system which is used on the continent. It's fantastic. It allows you to have these moving signal blocks, travel at higher speeds, get more trains into more space, but also have this in-cab display of upcoming signals. And we're looking at introducing it here, but the amount of time that it's taking to do so, and the cost of retrofitting hundreds, if not thousands, of rail vehicles is probably going to be a factor that comes into consideration.
Is that system similar to the one that exists in the Channel Tunnel, where you effectively have a safe zone in front of and behind the train? that moves with
I believe it is the same to all intents and purposes. I think it is the one that's used over in Europe already.
Do you think that we're going to get to a point where you're essentially, well, the train equivalent of flying using the instruments only?
I mean, theoretically, there's no reason why you couldn't under ECTMS. I think there's the open understanding that anything higher than 125 mile an hour is too fast to use line-side signals.
Right, because it's just gone too quickly.
Because the length of time that you've got to view the signal is too short. I mean, in some locations, that's definitely the case for curvature and things like that. I'd argue that the signals that are in place now with multiple LED bulbs in there, and they are brighter and visible from further afield. They did experiment on the East Coast Main Line at 140 mile an hour signalling. So there is a flashing green aspect that would precede a normal green, a solid green, that would give you that additional step of notification. But I think the answer now is to move to higher speeds, which there's no reason why we can't do. There's stock in the UK which is more than capable of travelling over 125 mile an hour, and there's probably rail which is flat and of sufficient quality to do it. But just that move to in-cab signalling is the next step to increasing those speeds.
And capacity, I think.
And capacity.
You know, as we have the two main trunk routes going north-south, but freight trains still need to use that too.
And that opens the whole HS2 conversation as well.
Podcast episode, actually. Let's
it might well be, yeah. I can think of one or two people far more qualified to talk to you about that as well.
Bring things back to the podcast then. What else are we going to hear coming up?
I've got a few in the pipeline. I'm going to be looking at this season doing Southall and Ladbroke Grove.
Well, these ones are really interesting to me because ones where it's I can remember them happening.
Yeah.
And I remember them being in the news. I think it's there was one that happened that you've covered, which was in Stafford, which is where I used to live.
Was it Rickerscore, by any chance?
That's the one. And I remember it happening. I didn't live there at the time, but I would know the area. And I remember reading the railway press that happened. And it's that thing about, you've definitely mentioned this before, about the sort of 9/11 effect or the Challenger disaster effect, where you remember where you were at a certain time.
And it is, I think, because a lot of the ones I've covered in the past, they are very much in the past. But there are, I kind of get, if you look at that TV program, Traffic Cops, I think, where they've got like the roads policing units and they follow them around. Well, they did a series that was from my home area. And I was watching the episode going, I know where that is. Bloody hell, that's outside my mate's house. It wasn't him, I hastened to add. But you get that thing where you see things you recognise and stuff resonates a little bit more. So I think doing some of the more recent ones will make it a little bit more relatable to people. And I'd always set out and said, look, there's probably 10 or 15 rail accidents that the general public will be aware of, they'll heard of, and the big ones. So it is sort of from that era, Potts Bar, Hatfield. And I've done some of them already, but I didn't want to do all of them straight away right at the start of season one.
I think that's a strength as well. I think that the fact that you cover different eras and it's not just, here's the history of rail accidents starting from the beginning and going to the present day.
Yeah.
It shows variation. And it's kind of like putting together a puzzle. You piece it together and how this evolution has come together. And I actually think that results in a better understanding of what's happened.
Because, yeah, if you start listening to episode one, there's concepts that I go into more detail with earlier on. And then every time I cover it since, I'll give it a slightly more slimmed down version. So I think it's in the episode on Irk Valley Junction on the outskirts of Manchester City Centre. I talked quite detail about absolute block signalling and how that worked. And then covering the next accident, that absolute block played a part and it was a few minutes less and a call back to that other episode if you want
to
hear more.
Well, I think at some point you can sort of assume a knowledge base amongst your listeners. Then,
yeah,
there's very few that are probably going to be coming in season three that haven't heard it before.
Yeah, it's one of those podcasts. I think people tend to start from the start and, and work the through. But no, so there's a few. So Ladbroke Grove, definitely.
Yeah.
Southall is probably going to be this season as well. I want to get some really significant ones in to talk about sort of culture changes in the industry. So Clapham Junction is going to rear its head as well this time round.
I guess from a pacing point of view as well with your series is you don't want to knock out all the big hitters early on.
Exactly.
Because otherwise it might also become a bit of fatigue.
Well, it's not only that. I think some of them deserve, more's not the right word, some of them deserve a real deep dive almost.
Yeah.
And that's why Carmont's ended up being a three-parter, because there's that much. And Carmont's massively significant because a lot of the episodes I've covered are from, even if you go back to Potter's Bar, the railway of yesteryear, and there was these fundamental flaws in the industry, and this changed, and now that shouldn't happen again. But Carmont's from the railway now.
Mm.
Carmont is, it's not talking about this horrible accident happened and this is what changed afterwards to prevent it. It's talking about all these safety systems that I've talked about in these previous 32 episodes or whatever it is, didn't stop this happening. So let's really understand why it did. So I think that's sort of the what I'm hoping to get from the Clapham Junction episode is lots of stuff happened because of this. There's lots of things that came out of it as positive improvements, but let's really understand.
Well, certainly growing up in the 90s, Clapham Junction was the one that always got referred back to. About anything to do with rail safety, everything got referred back to Clapham Junction. It was like, that was a big reset point.
Yeah, and that's why I want to... But I didn't want to do it right at the start of season one.
No.
Because it's worth covering in detail. And I don't want... You know, I think the other thing, which is quite a shame sometimes, I guess, is that some of the episodes I've covered haven't had... Even contemporarily,
contemporaneously, I think it is.
That is a better word than the one I tried to use. I haven't had this big media coverage, and there's ones I never knew about. And like my starting point for episodes was I went to Wikipedia and I opened the article page that was UK rail accidents. And
oh, that's a read. God, I've done that.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, someone once asked me, "Are you not going to run out of accidents?" And I just sent them a link to the page.
Yeah.
And said, no. There's been a few.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Well, sadly, but there has been a lot.
Yeah, it is a long pit. And some of them are, you know, there's a lot of, thankfully, zero fatality or one fatality or minor accidents. But there's a lot that aren't. But I want to make sure that those ones that no one has heard of or that haven't heard of outside of a limited geographical area or, you know, an industrial knowledge base... Make sure that those ones get talked about as well.
Yeah. How are you going to approach the more historical ones?
So my litmus test for whether I can cover an accident, or whether I will cover an accident, I think is fair, is whether or not there is an RAIB or equivalent report. I won't cover something that doesn't have it. It does open up things, interestingly, going forward. So Moorgate, for example, on the London Underground, that fits the bill. That will get covered at some point.
I mean, that one is truly terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sort of any Londoner's worst nightmare in terms of tube travel.
Yeah, and if you sort of you read reports of unpicking the scene at the end of that, that would have been horrific for anyone who was involved or close or saw it. But also that criteria gives me a bit more leeway. So contemporaneously on the list to cover at some point in the future is the Sandylands tram accident, which admittedly is... We talk about, you know, the last fatality on UK rail being Grey Rig prior to Carmont, but actually Sandylands had fatalities. It's light rail, but it's rail nonetheless.
And is this the incident that it's often referred to as the Croydon tram incident?
Croydon tram link.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. So that will be interesting to unpick it.
Mm.
But my first, sort of the first thing I do with any of them is first find out if they've got a report and then read it. There's a fantastic website called Railways Archive, which is... pretty much the only place I've managed to get a lot of the earlier ones, because they've got this fantastic collection, almost a library of railway documents, but particularly the grisly side of railways that I need to access. And to have a read through, and it's got to work as a story, and some of the ones I've found that I've looked at have either got, you know, we go back really far, and it's more sort of the accident returns as opposed to a full report, and something might sound very interesting and like I can make a story out of it, but if there's only two paragraphs that explain... This happened, it happened because of that, and I can't find any additional sources to support that. I'd really struggle to pull together an hour's episode out of it.
Mm.
But if the content's there, and I think it will make a story that people will engage with, then it's to the part of writing it.
Do you ever want to make a nice story where you just let your hair down a bit?
I would. I don't know whether this podcast would be the right place for it. But I think that's one of the reasons why I've covered... Wooten Bassett and Charles Fonton Latimer, because I don't just want to talk about accidents where there was an accident. And there's been a couple that I covered that have had zero fatalities. And just to sort of, it isn't all terrible. These stories do happen. They don't always have this really nasty ending, but we still have things we can learn from them.
Mm.
I think outside, you know, I'd love to do something that was a little bit more cheerful, but I think I'd probably have to do it under a different umbrella. I did toy with the YouTube channel doing sort of a Signals Explains, where I went into level crossing types and did a bit of a video around that with some very rudimentary Adobe After Effects animations.
Oh,
and And then sort of I did a Signals Explore where I did a bit of a tour of London and looked at some, well, I mean, that was fairly grisly because that was scenes of real accidents, but...
Yes, yeah, understand. You mentioned that you did an AWS special, but you probably won't be doing anything similar again, but why is that?
It was, I think I would look at it again, but I'd need to get the format of it right. So I did that as a podcast episode that was a sort of a standalone short. And there was feedback from some people that found it very interesting, but the people sort of wanted just more content that was normal Signals to Danger. Admittedly, this was probably the fifth or sixth episode I'd ever uploaded. So I don't know whether I would look to revisit that as a concept with, you know, a bigger listener base that I've got now.
Right.
Or whether that's the right sort of thing for the YouTube channel, something like that. Sort of step away from the actual podcast. The problem, I think, with doing something as a hobby is that I get very big ideas sometimes about wonderful things I'd like to do with it, but time is very much a limitation.
I recognise that. That's anybody who does this kind of thing. I've got a few more questions from listeners. So yeah. Will asks a couple of questions, actually. How long does it take you to make an episode?
Oh, it depends how good I'm being. as a general rule, I mean, I know that I've recently had quite a hiatus between season 2 and season 3 because, quite frankly, life just really got in the way. And stress from outside of the podcast kind of limited my ability to do it. But generally speaking, when I'm on a roll, it's about a week to research and write the script. And then if... 3-year-old daughter allows, the record and the edit is done in that one night. I've got myself to a point where I'm quite happy with the workflow on the edit.
And also you're confident in your voice as well and your ability to strike the right pace and tone and everything else like that.
And I think one of the things that really helps with that is that I write the script like I talk. It's very much, there probably is a more efficient way of writing it with bullet points, etc. But the way that works for me is it's almost a transcript before it even gets recorded.
So it goes head, paper, mouth.
That pretty much.
Great.
Internet.
Internet. And of all the ones you've covered so far, what has had the biggest impact personally for you?
Oh, that is a really, really challenging one. I mean, it's Carmont probably at this point in time, because I've got very involved in it. I work on the railway. I sort of talk in episode 1 about I was at work doing railway things when it all happened, and you know it was all part of we were all talking about it. It was very much at the forefront of everyone's mind. But prior to that one, some of the accidents have been pretty, because it's writing about people's very worst days, which is I won't say mentally draining is not the right word. There was one that I did back at the end of season 1, I think it was, on Stapleton Road.
Yeah, well, local
which
to
was
me,
just,
Bristol.
Yeah, yeah. It, just 4 guys were doing their job and never went home at the end of the day. Mm. And that one was, there's nothing as defenseless against a railway as just a random person, you know, an individual. There's never a version of events where they'll come off better than the train. And so that one was quite poignant to write. I think one I got very involved in and went to, probably by virtue of where it was Lockington. So that's July 1986. That's the one where someone drives a car out onto a crossing and derails a passenger train.
Yeah.
But that was the line between Scarborough and Hull. At the time, I was the station manager at Hull. It was very local to me. So I had the really nice opportunity that I don't normally get to actually go out to Lockington and stand there and look. And
well, another popular podcaster, James Holland, he's obsessed with this idea of walking the ground, of whatever you're talking about, go there in 3D space in real life and experience it, and then you'll be able to explain it properly.
And it really was, and it felt, and there was a cracking book as well that I used quite heavily for that one called Crash at the Crossing, and that, you know, had a bit of conversation with the author back and forth, talking about the book and asking if it was fine for me to use it for the podcast, and I got that was one that I felt personally like I'd got the production value quite well, but I think that was because I'd gone there and I'd seen it. I felt very invested in that episode. That would be up until more recently, where I've upgraded a bit of kit and got my head around you know, the workflows better on the post production. But that was the one that I'd show to someone as, look, this is what the podcast's about. Listen to this one.
Great. I actually think that production value is one of my favourite things about your podcast. because I think it shows that you actually care. You care about the listener experience. It is done as an immersive story. You've thought about the pacing, stuff like that. You've thought about the listener journey and what the listener might know, what knowledge you can assume, and how you paint a picture using words, and what information you introduce at what time. So I think that high production value is one of my favourite things about your podcast.
And that, I think, for anyone who's ever thinking of starting a podcast, as a reassurance to you, up until halfway through season two, I was using a mic that I got off Amazon for £40.
Nice.
I've upgraded slightly now. I think I've been doing it long enough that I've felt comfortable buying something with Rode written on the side of it. It very much was on the cheap. The first half of season one's edited in a free piece of software.
Absolutely. I don't think that technical limitations should be the gatekeeping of creating media. I think that holding yourself to a certain standard of how you deliver things is the key thing.
And I know, I think what I want to do, I'm not fussy or anal or anything like that, but I knew that if I was going to do this, I wanted it to sound proper, as this sort of really cliched catch-all term. So I think throughout, I've tweaked it, and people who've listened the whole time will notice that the format's changed slightly in the way that I use music and things like that, which I hasten to add is not stolen, it's all licensed.
Good.
But that, you know, I want it to feel like, you know, that someone who is does this for a living has created it, and you know that the content is of a quality that you actually want to listen to.
Brilliant. This is the last question. It's from a Twitter user. If you and I swapped roles, how would you take it on? I think that's a question for both of us. So can I go first about how I would do your podcast?
Yeah,
I would learn to read properly first, and actually concentrate when I'm reading, because I have this, you know, mental block about walls of text. I think I'd have to step up my game in terms of just research. Like I have done a few solo episodes, like, you know, there's the one on like Victorian excursions and stuff like that, and I find it exhausting to sit there solo and power through it. And so I think that's something that I would really have to work on in order to do anything close to Signals of Danger. I think that I would have to calm down, because I, as you can tell, my voice gets quite excitable, especially when I talk about railways, my favourite subject. So I think I'd have to calm down quite a lot and bring that sort of la, 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 la voice down a bit.
Well, I think, to be fair, if it makes you feel, the research is exhausting. no matter what you do, it is, because sometimes there's definitely been times I've sat there on the sofa while my wife watches something on TV, and I've just sat rubbing my eyes thinking, what does that word even mean?
And you're trying, is that a word?
It exactly, and trying to understand it. But I think if we were to swap places, I think one of the things I like most about yours is just that fantastic conversational interaction you have with guests. I think I am very much that I'm good at writing things. That's, you know, even day to day life at work, I can pull a report together, I can put a bit. I'm very good at writing something, and the rest is just reading it out. Once a script's written, that's the point where I think, right, podcast is done.
But this ties into what you're talking about, workflows.
Yeah.
This is how you get that repeatability, is you work out something that works for yourself and that you can fit into your life.
So, but you've got this thing, you know, we've been talking today and you've come up with another question, and I just sort of sit there going, what should I ask them now?
Well, do you think we're going to see guests appear on the Signals of Danger specials at some point?
So
I'm not just saying that so you'd put me on it, but
One of the things I'd like to do, not necessarily guests, so to speak, but I've recently put out a sort of an appeal for people who have personal memories of accidents I'm looking to cover in the near future, and I'd love to integrate, maybe not necessarily interviews, but another person's account of things. I think that, because I am always thinking about how can I add a bit more depth to it, how can I increase the value that people get out of it. And I think if I was able to hand over and say John was on the train on the day, and then just have a brief John's account, him telling me what his experience of it was, I think that would really add something to it.
Yeah.
It's definitely not the, you know, it's a storytelling podcast. And I think if I was going to get someone on, would an interview be the best format? Or would it's a storytelling thing, so would that better be just them telling a portion of it?
It's what you're talking about is almost like an eyewitness account compared to a co-presenter.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's something I'm toying with. Mm-hmm.
great.
But it would be a new thing for the podcast. But three-parters was a new thing for the podcast, and people didn't seem to mind that.
Yeah. Oh, as I said before, you know, we've got a pause button. You know, if you feel like it's overrunning, I'm just going to come back to it anyway.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff to look forward to, if that is the right phrase. I do look forward to them. I think the focus on education and the focus on safety and what we've talked about here is something that we definitely need. And I think more public appreciation of that and, you know, enthusiast appreciation of that is always a good thing.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm looking forward to many more episodes in the future. And I'd just like to say thank you so much for coming on this podcast and indulging me talking about this subject. Well,
thank you for having me. I think, like I said, most of what I do is write a script and read it out. So it's quite nice to talk about it sometimes. Also, even though it does unveil my more amateur status sometimes in terms of the knowledge.
Mate, I'm a professional amateur. Don't worry about it.
I think most podcasters are.
Yeah, definitely. A keen amateur.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Dan. See you later.
No, thank you.